The Catcher Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catcher AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into something significant, a work that's caused a huge amount of conversation and, well, fundamentally challenged how America thinks about its history. The 1619 Project, a new origin story led by the journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. Our goal here really is pretty straightforward. We want to unpack the book's core argument, which is, you know, pretty radical, this idea that America's whole starting point needs to shift. And we want to give you the context for why understanding that shift helps explain so many divisions and inequalities we see today.
Yeah, and it's so relevant right now because it really makes you confront that traditional story, the 1776 founding myth. If you start there, it's all about liberty, ideals, revolution.
Right, the familiar narrative. Exactly.
Yeah.
But the 1619 Project says, hang on, the real beginning, the moment that shaped everything, was August 1619, when that first ship carrying enslaved Africans arrived. If you shift the starting line there, well, the whole story changes. Slavery isn't just a footnote, it becomes foundational.
So the book argues we have to face that history to even understand, let alone fix, the problems baked in from the start.
Precisely. It posits that honest confrontation is the only way forward.
Okay, so let's talk about the person driving this, Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's not coming at this purely as an academic historian, is she? Her background is different.
Right, she's an investigative reporter first and foremost, and a really acclaimed one. Known for deep, hard-hitting work on civil rights, racial inequality, looking at the systems behind it all.
The data, the evidence.
Exactly. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 2020, specifically for the essay that introduces this whole project. Plus, she's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. So she brings this incredible journalistic rigor, this relentless pursuit of facts, which maybe complements traditional historical scholarship in a unique way.
And yet, it's not just dry facts, is it? The writing has this narrative power. It feels personal.
Well, I think that comes from her perspective, you know, as a Black American woman exploring a history that's not abstract for her, it's lived, it shapes her family's story. She talks very movingly about her father, his patriotism, even despite, as she puts it, the country's failures.
That combination.
Yeah, the rigor of the investigation combined with that personal lived urgency. That's what gives the project so much weight, I think. That's why it's resonated and also why it's stirred controversy.
Okay, let's really pin down this core idea because it's the big shift. The book says the real founding date isn't July 4th, 1776, but August 1619, the day the White Lion ship arrived in Virginia with enslaved Africans.
And that single change changes everything. It means slavery isn't some regrettable chapter or a stain on an otherwise noble story.
Which is how it's often taught.
Right. Instead, it becomes the foundation. The book argues slavery is absolutely central to America's identity, its laws, its economic power, its culture, even its wealth. It asks, what happens if you put the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans right at the very center of the American narrative?
Now, that's obviously a challenging idea for many. It goes against a lot of established history. How does the book handle that, particularly around, say, the motivations of the founders in 1776?
Well, it leans into the paradox. It acknowledges the founders spoke of liberty, but, you know, many were slaveholders who built a system based on racial slavery. The different essays in the book use a ton of research to show how the economics of slavery and the need to protect that system constantly shaped laws, policies, even the Constitution.
So it's not just about ignoring 1776.
No, not at all. It's about saying you can't only look at the stated ideals of 1776 without looking at the brutal reality that made those ideals hypocritical for millions from day one. It's about holding both truths at the same time.
And the structure of the book itself seems designed to make this comprehensive case, right? It's not just one narrative voice.
Exactly. It's an anthology, a collection.
Yeah.
You've got 18 major essays, really deep dives by top historians, sociologists, journalists, laying out the evidence. But then woven between them are 17 creative pieces, poems, short stories.
Art.
Yeah, visual art too, by leading Black artists. And that mix is deliberate. The essays kind of dismantle the old myths with facts and analysis, while the creative works give you the emotional core, the human experience of living through and resisting this 400-year history.
Okay, let's dig into some of those specific sections. They really trace this legacy through different parts of American life. We have to start with democracy, right? That's Hannah-Jones' opening essay. And she tackles that core paradox head on. The ideals in the Declaration, liberty, equality, she argues they were false when they were written because they were written by men who owned other people. But then she reframes it. The argument becomes that Black Americans, the very people excluded from those promises, have actually been the ones fighting for centuries to make those ideals real. For everyone.
Right, through resistance, through struggle. She uses figures like Crispus Attucks, the Black man killed first in the Boston Massacre, as a symbol. He died fighting for a liberty he himself was denied.
So the fight for Black freedom isn't just a separate story.
No, the book argues it's central to the story of American democracy itself. From abolition to civil rights, those struggles didn't just benefit Black people. They pushed America closer to its own ideals, expanding rights for all kinds of groups. In a way, it positions Black Americans as the key perfecters of American democracy.
Wow. Okay, so if democracy's roots are intertwined with 1619, what about wealth? Matthew Desmond's chapter on capitalism. That one really makes you stop and think.
Oh, it's incredibly provocative. His argument is that modern American capitalism isn't just vaguely influenced by slavery. It's a direct descendant of the plantation system.
How so? What's the mechanism there?
Well, think about the plantation. It wasn't just farming. It was a highly sophisticated, brutal, and efficient system for extracting maximum profit from forced labor. Plantation owners, Desmond argues, were pioneers of techniques we now associate with modern business.
Like what?
Like meticulous record keeping, tracking output per person, depreciation of assets. Only the assets were human beings. They developed complex financial instruments using enslaved people as collateral. Things like setting specific tasks to measure and maximize daily work, that's an early form of efficiency management.
So the ruthless efficiency we sometimes admire in business, its origins are darker than we think.
That's the argument, that the relentless drive for profit, the detailed accounting, the management techniques aimed at maximizing extraction, a lot of that was honed on the plantation and then became part of the DNA of American capitalism. The sheer scale of wealth created was built on this industrialized exploitation.
That is unsettling. And it leads into the next area, doesn't it? Justice or injustice. Bryan Stevenson's chapter on punishment connects slavery directly to mass incarceration today.
Yes, and this is a crucial link many people miss. When the 13th Amendment supposedly abolished slavery, it left in this massive loophole.
The exception clause.
Exactly. It says slavery and involuntary servitude are abolished except as punishment for a crime. And that exception was immediately exploited, especially in the South.
Through convict leasing.
Right. States would arrest Black men, often on flimsy charges like vagrancy, convict them, and then lease them out as forced labor to private companies, mines, railroads, farms. The state got revenue, the companies got incredibly cheap labor, and it was basically slavery by another name.
And Stevenson argues that system just evolved.
It evolved from convict leasing into the debt peonage and harsh laws of Jim Crow, and then later morphing into the racial disparities we see in the war on drugs and the modern criminal justice system. It's presented as one continuous system of racial control adapting over time.
The book even takes us into unexpected places, like medicine, Linda Villarosa's chapter.
Yeah.
That was eye-opening. The idea that myths created to justify slavery are still affecting medical care?
It's shocking, but the evidence is there. To rationalize enslaving people, pseudoscientific ideas were spread, things like Black people having thicker skin or being less sensitive to pain or having naturally weaker lungs. Utter nonsense, biologically.
But created deliberately.
Created deliberately to justify brutal treatment and forced labor. The truly devastating part, Villarosa points out, is that remnants of these false beliefs still linger, sometimes unconsciously, in the medical field today.
Leading to what?
Leading to Black patients, for example, being undertreated for pain. It contributes to major health disparities. Look at the tragically high rates of Black maternal mortality. These aren't new problems. They have deep historical roots in these manufactured myths.
And finally, culture. Wesley Morris writes about music, which feels like both a celebration and a complication.
Yeah, it's the gift and the paradox, right? The argument is that almost all uniquely American popular music, jazz, blues, gospel, rock and roll, R&B, hip hop, Cher, it all flows directly from the traditions created by enslaved and later free Black Americans.
The soundtrack of freedom, as the book calls it.
Right. Music born from pain, resilience, joy, resistance. It becomes the sound of America to the world. But the paradox is that while the culture was embraced, even appropriated globally, the Black creators were often systematically shut out from the economic rewards and even the credit because of the very same racial structures the music fought against.
So looking across all these chapters, democracy, capitalism, justice, medicine, culture, what are the big overarching themes tying it all together?
Well, three really stand out. The first is definitely the persistence of racial caste. The book hammers home that systems of racial control didn't just vanish in 1865.
They changed form.
Exactly. They morphed. From chattel slavery, you get convict leasing, then Jim Crow segregation, then things like redlining and housing, which creates a modern wealth gap. The form changes, but the underlying goal of maintaining a racial hierarchy persists.
Okay, that's one. What's the second?
The second is a really powerful reframing. Black Americans as the primary agents of democracy. It flips the script. Instead of victims, it highlights the centuries of struggle for black liberation as the main force that actually pushed America to live up to its own creed.
Expanding rights for everyone in the process.
Precisely. It frames that struggle as the essential work of perfecting democracy for all Americans, making it a deeply patriotic act, in a way.
Interesting. And the third theme?
The third is about the invention and weaponization of race itself. The book is crystal clear. Race isn't biological. It's a social construct, a legal fiction.
Created for a purpose?
Absolutely. Oh. Created deliberately in colonial times through laws designed to establish a permanent hierarchy. To justify taking land from Native Americans and exploiting African people for labor, race was invented as a tool of power and control.
It's powerful how the book takes these huge historical forces and makes them stick in your mind. There are some core ideas, almost like quotes, even if paraphrased, that are hard to forget.
Yeah, like that one about democracy's ideals being false when they were written, and that it was the struggle of Black Americans that has worked to make them true. That really captures that second theme we just talked about.
Definitely. And the economic one. The plantation was America's first big business, and its legacy of exploitation continues to shape our economic life today. That really brings slavery out of the distant past and connects it to, well, right now.
Right into our wallets, almost. And maybe the most direct summary of the political argument. Democracy may not exist without Black Americans. That's a bold statement.
It is. It forces you to reconsider who the real drivers of democratic expansion have been.
So how does understanding all this help us, you know, in the real world? What are the applications? Well, the biggest thing is it provides a completely different framework for understanding current events. Suddenly, debates about voting rights or police reform or the wealth gap, they don't look like isolated issues anymore.
You see them as part of a much longer pattern.
Exactly. As logical outcomes of this 400-year history shaped by deliberate choices, it helps you connect the dots between the past and the present in a really profound way.
Which could lead to a different kind of citizenship, maybe? More critical, perhaps?
I think so. Mm. A more mature patriotism, maybe? One that doesn't require ignoring the failures. The book encourages you, the listener, to look again at national symbols, holidays, monuments, and understand the complex, often contradictory history they represent. It allows you to hold both the ideals and the failures.
And there are practical applications too, right? You mentioned city planners earlier.
Absolutely. Take the chapter on traffic. If you're a city planner today and you understand how highways were intentionally routed in the past to destroy or isolate black neighborhoods, that history has to inform how you approach building equitable infrastructure now. Same for doctors understanding the history of medical myths or educators understanding how history has been taught. It provides essential context for doing better work today.
That traffic chapter detail, linking segregation to modern Atlanta traffic jams, that really struck me too. It's so concrete. But thinking back on everything, what really stands out most for you? For me, I think it was that specific link between plantation management and modern corporate finance. It just felt chillingly direct.
It's a good one. For me, I think it's the overall paradigm shift the book achieves. It succeeds in moving slavery from the margins, where it's often treated, right to the absolute center of the American story. And maybe the most important takeaway for you listening is this. The book shows that systemic inequality wasn't an accident. It wasn't inevitable.
It was built.
It was built through deliberate policy choices over centuries. And the flip side of that, the hopeful side, is that if it was built by choices, it can be dismantled by new choices, different choices, aimed at actual justice and equity. That's a powerful and ultimately actionable message.
It really is a powerful, challenging, and necessary conversation to have. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.